Morning. My name is Bob Bazans, and I'm an alcoholic. My group is the Summit Hill Group in St. Paul, Minnesota. My sobriety date is December 10th, 1967. I'm a past delegate, panel 29, and my mother dresses me most of the time. And Norma, most people feel that I do better when I don't spend much time with people. I'm real good over the telephone, and I'm fairly good on tape. It's in person that I have most of the difficulties that I have. So I try to stay away from the people who are introducing me, so I don't so I don't irritate them too much just before I go to talk. I was feeling pretty good this morning until I saw the group from Pittsburgh. Bill opened the conference, my friend Bill. But Bill is with a couple of other guys. There's three guys who are attorneys, and they all have, two of them have 35 years, and one guy's got about 30. And one of them is wearing a badge that he's the judge of leads, that he judges the veracity, the levity, and the brevity of the leads. And I don't know. I think had they really had such an organization that a few other of us would have had the cards, but I think he made it up. And got a lot of friends here this morning. That's nice. I enjoyed Frank. Frank sponsors my son. And Linda and I have three children right now in the program. We have a 29-year-old who is 10 years sober and lives in New York. And a 27-year-old who is 7 years sober that lives in Los Angeles. And an 18-year-old, almost 18-year-old, that is just still damp, but brand new. And the, process. When you have children in the program, I guess there wouldn't be almost another case, maybe other than a parent or a sister or brother, that you would really want help for those people more than anything else in success. And they don't want the help from you, you know, which is the other thing. They've gotten what they're going to get pretty much from you. You know, they, for good and bad. Yeah, it's, you know, it's kind of hard to alter once they're in their, you know, mid-20s. And they don't follow your directions. They don't want to, you know, select sponsors, you know, that you would. And my son went to New York and selected Frank, who I never would have chosen. And I might have even given Bill Frank's name. But it's terrific. It is when your kids find that coupling up, which I think is a real chemistry sort of thing. You know, it isn't, you can send someone to someone who you think is the best AA in the world, and if the chemistry isn't there for whatever reason, it just won't work. And that's really nice. It is just really great. June's talking tonight, and June is one of my other son's supports in Los Angeles. And, you know, it's just cool. And so was Clint, you know. So it's just nice to know that your kids can connect and find the same sort of principles and access to the thing and love, but yet direction, you know, which is one of the things. And that's really great. I just love the universality of the program. I like that it's everywhere. And some places think they own it. They think they have the brand of AA that no one else has. And I'm one of the group to think that, wow. I'm not of that school. I'm one of the group that thinks that somehow we struggle along in Minnesota and stay sober. No one thinks Minnesota has it, by the way. And that's why very few of us get asked to share. And they let me do it. Now, they like to say that I'm not from Minnesota. They like me to say that I'm not from Minnesota, so when I travel. So at any rate, I'm glad to be here. This is a heck of a conference. I have never, this is like coming to a small international. You know, I mean, it's, you know, the program and the organization. And I'm very impressed with what Deborah and Joe have done. I appreciate the I am sure a cast of hundreds. You know, they're just, you just don't do this without everything from the huggers to the program committee to the, I mean, this is a big deal. But it is highly organized. It's a great hotel. I just Really enjoyed it. I listened to Sister last night talk about the size of a room. I also have one of those rooms, and I'm here with my friend Keith, and there's a few other, he's from my home group, and there's a few other people here from St. Paul, and a couple of other transplants. We have some transplants that are coming to Florida, so, well, I better start sharing. I started drinking when I was 14. And I was a freshman in high school. I was 4'11". I weighed 95 pounds. I was the second smallest kid in my high school class. As far back as I can remember, I never liked who or what I was. I always wanted to be something different, bigger, better looking, wanted to be an athlete. You know, had a big mouth, always tried to compensate for the fact that I was a small kid, I was likely to be the person who was always trying to get attention, loud mouth, and doing things that were daring that no one else would do. I felt like everybody else got to school an hour early and held a meeting and talked about what was going to go on through the day, and I always missed the meeting. I meant to get to it. And then you're the only kid in the school who didn't go to the meeting, so you had to pretend you were at the meeting. Great meeting, wasn't it? Great meeting, and keep, you know, trying to hope they'd talk about the meeting. And always trying to catch up. And a friend of mine who now has 28 years of sobriety, when his father died, we copped the fifth, and we went out and we split that fifth. And my life changed. It was, I don't know what is wrong with some of us that we just have the sense of dis-ease. And see, now there's the other guy from Minnesota. He's late. He's coming up the middle aisle. Hi, Terry. He's, good morning, Terry. Terry has 25 years of sobriety, and he transplanted down here to Florida, down in the Tampa area, and it's really nice to see him make the effort to drive down here. Even if he's Irish, he's an awfully good guy, Bill. I had a sense of dis-ease, and I don't know why, you know, so many of us have that kind of chemistry that a half pint or a pint makes us feel okay, normal, as opposed to, you know, it returns us to a sense of normalcy. I felt with a half pint in me like you looked most of the time. I had a noise in my head all the time. My amplifier was always up around 8 or 9, and there was something in a few drinks that take my amplifier from about 9 down to about 3, and it just would give me a sense of ease that I just, you know. And when I had that experience, it was like I discovered a secret. I mean, it was magical. And I went back after that secret as often as a young guy could. By the time I finished high school, I had a serious drinking problem. I thought my serious drinking problem was that I got caught a lot. And when either my father caught me or the police caught me, they never liked the idea that a 15, 16, 17-year-old was drunk on a continuous basis, and it didn't matter how much you drank. One drink, you got in trouble. 5 drinks, you got in trouble. 15 drinks, you know, so I never wanted to get caught with one drink. Never made sense to me. And so I figured that when I, you know, eventually could drink like an adult, you know, my drinking would normalize. Right now what I'm doing is just making sure I don't get in trouble for having no fun. And so when I went away to school, that was a big part of how that, but my drinking never normalized. To make a long story short, I drank my way out of the University of Notre Dame in the middle of my senior year. One day I just walked out, and I was in civil engineering carrying 25 credits a semester. It gets kind of tough to bluff your way through a thermodynamics exam. I was going to school about one day a week and just kind of ran my string out. And AA returned you to many spots. I went back after about 10 years of sobriety or 12 years of sobriety to give a talk at Notre Dame. And Frank Milos came with us. There's a gal who's here from Milos' group. And it was a big deal. I had all these memories, and I had some amends I wanted to make. And I went back there, and I'm talking to about 2,000 people. I'm in the middle of my talk, and I said, you know, I've always, you know, for a normal question, you know, you ask them, where'd you go to school? And it isn't that there's a pause, and it isn't that we don't want to answer. We just don't know how much time you have. And uh, And that was me. I went to Notre Dame for 3.5 years and walked out, and then I went someplace else for a year and got a degree. And I always wondered, do you tell them where you went most of the time, and where, you know, or do you tell them where you got the, you know, are you married? You know, and there's this kind of perplexing look on their face. Do you have children? You know, that's kind of a, you know, it's not a normal question for a lot of alcoholics. Do you work? You know, I don't know why that is. These are compound questions. So I was always, I don't know, I mean, no one gives a damn. You know, I mean, that's the question, they're social questions. Where'd you go to school? Who gives a root, right? And so I was always, you know, this little click, and I'm down there in Notre Dame, I'm giving this AA talk, and I said, you know, I've always had a deep sense of failure about this place. I said, I just figured out why. I said, I think it's because I failed. If we're looking for insights this morning, you might want to get a cup of coffee and kind of chill out. And I was due to be commissioned as an officer in the Army. I was in ROTC, and I had to get a medical release. The medical release I got was for alcoholism. I was diagnosed an alcoholic when I was 19 years old. We talk about psychiatrists, you know, they don't know what's going on. I found one that, you know, 19, nailed me. And neat guy, still see him. And not, you know, socially, and I see other psychologists personally and professionally. He's a little senile, and I don't want to go to him. You know, I mean, I'm kidding. And great guy. And, you know, so I went home, and got me out of the Army, and I finished school. And by the time I finished school, my father asked me to leave home. He said, we love you, and we care about you. There's six other kids in the family. You're a gigantic pain in the ass. And, you know, you just can't follow the rules, and good luck. And so I went out to make my mark. I took a position as a carry-out boy in a liquor store, and didn't work out real well. Almost killed a little girl back in a driveway one morning with the automobile drunk, and I lost the job for going 80 miles an hour and getting arrested, and started working as a waiter at the private club in Minneapolis. I'm living not on Skid Row, but $5 a night hotel rooms, and I have an apartment in St. Paul, 6 miles away. I think in the 6 months I worked as a waiter, I made it home about six nights, and had two paper bags, you know, got up in the morning, drank a couple of beers, went to work. Worked as a waiter from, you know, about 11 to 2. At 2, I went to a bar and drank beer till 5, and at 5, I went and bought a pint or a half pint or a fifth and kept it in the locker, and somewhere during that day, I'd find a place to live or someone to stay with, and you know, Dr. Seuss, that child author, those are actual photographs of people I lived with during that period of time in my life. And things are not going well. And I went to a party one night, got my face kicked in, and I got fired as a waiter, and I was tapped. I had no place to go. And I went back home and asked if I could move back in the house. They hadn't seen me for better part of a year, and they said, yeah, if you don't drink, you can move back in like a good little drunk. I promise not to drink, move back in. Alcoholism meant a lot of different things to me, but like one of the things more than anything else is it meant about every 6 months I had to start my life over. I was always starting over, and it was going to be different. And it never was different. It was different for a day or a week, but sometimes a month, not often for a month. But somehow the wheels always came off it, and it was back where it was, and as confusing to me as it was to everybody else. You know, I think my father was the most, I think if you would have put my father and I in a room and asked him what he wanted for me, you know, and what I wanted for me, the two lists would have looked alike. You couldn't have convinced anybody in my family that what I wanted for me was what they wanted. It looked like I was hell-bent for self-destruction and to dirty everything that, you know, we valued. And it wasn't true. I just didn't know how to do it. I mean, I really wanted the, you know, progress, and I just never, it seems like I had a built-in failure mechanism. But at this point in time, I thought I'd really try to restructure my life. I got back together with the girl that I'd gone with for a couple of years, and we broke up for almost a year, and we got engaged and married. Today, she's my very lovely wife, Linda. Neat lady, active member of Al-Anon. She just got her 31-year pin in Al-Anon. And I have really done a good job with her. And I have been a constant source of growth for her, and I don't think she'd have half the program she has if it wasn't for some of the opportunities. And I got a job as an executive trainee, bought my first car, and I thought, wow, it's really going to happen. It didn't happen. I could not shut my drinking down. I was a bar drinker, and I just, after work, I just, you know, just had to have a couple, and I'd go in to have a couple, and 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 1 o'clock, you know, just pounding the bar saying, gee, it happened again. You know, and I use up my sick leave the first month of work, you know, and I'm just, you know, I'm, you know, late all the time and falling asleep in the John, and they're, you know, it's just, you know, this is, I'm, you know, at Notre Dame, I was the class drunk. They used my room as a study hall. They, three guys petitioned to have me removed from the civil engineering school. You know, I mean, I was the class drunk, and now I am the company drunk. I am Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and I just can't, you know, big corporation, I mean, they're tough. They like to have you come in on Mondays and stay on Friday. I mean, it's not, you know, this is not, you know, it's rigid. And so I quit that job, took a sales job, and I had the sales job about a month, 6 weeks, and I went out on a three-day drunk. A buddy of mine got married. Weddings were always good for about a week. And I woke up Thursday afternoon, just panicked. Didn't know if I had a job, a fiancé, or a place to live until I was married. And I just, you know, and I called AA, which my father had recommended, my psychiatrist had recommended, and I never want. So I called, I got Stu down at central office, and he got on the phone and he talked to me for about 10 minutes and told him I had a drinking problem. And he got in another line, called a couple of guys, and he said, could you go meet a couple of guys at the St. Clair Broiler, which is a little cafe that we have in St. Paul, in about an hour and a half? And I said, yeah, I could. And I called into work and found out I still had a job, and called Linda and found out I was still engaged, and called home and found out they were concerned rather than mad. And I thought, why in the hell did you call Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, I mean, you always feel guilty. I could always tell when I felt guilty I was awake. And, you know, just, you know. And, but here's where I think God acted in my life. I had this curiosity. I wanted to go see what an alcoholic looked like. And I did. That's how shallow I was. And so I went and met these two guys about 4:30, 5 o'clock one afternoon at the St. Clair Broiler. And when you're young and in trouble, you get waltzed in front of an awful lot of people for help, psychiatrists and psychologists and bishops and rectors and deans and lawyers and judges and, you know, all sorts of stuff. And, I you know, you're always in trouble. They're always asking you questions. They usually are talking to your parents, and then they have a recommendation. I thought this was going to be, you know, a couple of more guys were going to ask me a bunch of questions. And I sat down with these two men. One guy was younger, and he had 6 months. The other guy was a little bit older than I was, and he had 6 years. And they said, look, we're members of Alcoholics Anonymous. We used to have a drinking problem. We think we found an answer for ourselves, and we're here as much for ourselves as we're here for you. We find that doing this helped. You know, they weren't getting a toaster for signing me up. There was not a multi-level marketing meeting. It was just a... And they sat me down, and they shared their story with me. I had never, up until that time, I had never talked to another person who had the same problem I had, or talked to me in a way that shared, and it changed my life. You know, we have many traditions in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think the finest tradition we have is that we share our experience, strength, and hope, and not our thinking. There is, no, but so many powerful things, and churches and everything else have devolved from the spiritual into conceptual. You know, they just have lost their power. You can give the information, but the information doesn't often move the stars anymore. These two men shared their life with me, and it altered my life. I drank twice after that night, but it altered my life. There was something mystical or magical or one spiritual about that communication. It touched me in a way. My life was not the same after that communication, period. Went to my first meeting that night, and I was able to make a couple of discoveries over the next couple of months, which allowed me to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. I drank twice, as I say, after walking in, once on a business trip to the West Coast, and I didn't call AA like I was told to. Got drunk after a week, got in a bunch of trouble, and then I came back, got sober for about 3 months, and then we went on our honeymoon, and I drank on our honeymoon, which I think I had some push down, denied, little suppression there. I think I had that planned. And I always like those little surprises where I have it planned, but I don't know it. And, you know, and delightful little moments. And, you know, comes out as a complete surprise, and then you look back at it and find out it's been there for about a year and a half. And then, we honeymooned in Acapulco. You know where the divers dive off those? I drove off those cliffs on my last drunk. I was in the audience watching a World High Diving Contest. I thought, God, that's not so tough. And I went over and introduced myself to the ex-president of Mexico. His nephew had been my roommate at Notre Dame for a while. He was not impressed. His bodyguard, I was just blind drunk and just, you know, the ugly American. This is not pretty now if you're talking about it. And I drove off the public landing, started to climb up the cliff. Now, I split my swimsuit. I cut my leg. My wife is going absolutely nuts. You know, we're married 4 days and this horse's ass is up. You know, I get up about 85, and I get stuck, and I can't get up. You can't climb down. I mean, you ever try to climb down? I'm stuck. I'm really am. And I'm trying to decide whether to jump or dive. I'm looking down. There's a bunch of water comes in and goes out. You know, and I finally figured out the hell with it, and I dove. And God watches after, you know, fools and drunks because I made it. And now Norm Alpey used to talk about seconds and inches. You know, if I would have jumped, I would have died. Can't get out far enough. You have to get out almost 30 feet to get out in the middle. And I didn't know that, you know. And we used to go back all the time. After about our fifth anniversary, went back about every year with the kids. And my 10th anniversary, we were up there watching the divers, and she gave me this little card that said, "But for the grace of God," and showed a picture of the chasm. And we were about midnight, we're watching the diver. I said, "God, that's the dumbest thing I've ever done." And she said, "Honey, it's not even in the top 10." And I don't know why two people look at life. I mean, it's the same experience, and we have such a different view of it. I gained a little weight, and I've been a little out of shape, and she wanted me to get some exercise. I thought I'd buy a bike, and I bought a bike, and she didn't like it. I bought a Harley, and I don't know. I keep doing things for her, and it just never seems to be enough. And but now I'm brand new in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I go in there and make two discoveries that change my life. One is alcoholism is a disease. You know, I thought everybody knew that. I didn't know it. And it was that concept was important to me, and that I was sick, not a bad guy. And that once I, you know, it was a threefold disease, physical, mental, and spiritual. Once I crossed the line from problem drinking to alcoholism, my alcoholism affected me all the time when I was drinking and when I was not drinking. Boy, that piece I needed, because I had tried sobriety just before I went back to my senior year. I was sober for almost 3 months. I got beaten up, robbed, rolled, pistol whipped, shot at, thrown out of the second story of a hotel, ended up in a psych ward, and they wanted me to go back. We're not going to let me go back to school, but let me go back on the condition that I wouldn't drink, and I went back and didn't drink for 3 months. And my life didn't instantaneously get better. It didn't all of a sudden become what I thought you were telling me I'd become if I just wouldn't drink. And I knew that there had to be something more than bourbon did not, bourbon was my answer, not my problem. You know, it caused me a little difficulty, but by and large, it was as consistent and as wonderful as anything I'd ever found in life. And but when you told me that it was mental and spiritual, and that it affected me drinking and not drinking, that started to explain some things to me that I had to know. The other thing I learned is that there was an awful lot of people in those room who drank a lot of booze, and now they weren't doing it. The only reason they weren't doing it is they liked what they found in sobriety better than what they found in a bottle. And that was an interesting thought. I thought I might have to quit, but boy, I thought my life was over. I mean, I just, not drinking was not very attractive. I didn't like that idea much at all. If I listened to your stories and you were out there taking a pretty good swing at it, and you got to the point where it was too much for you and then you quit and your lives weren't over, there was a zest and a vitality and an energy and a joy and a sense of humor that I have loved and a sense of irreverence that I have loved since I've come in the program. So I'm 24 years old and I'm sober. I was always one of these guys, great starter, poor finisher, lots of potential, that sort of thing. And I thought, but now I've got the answer. What's been wrong with me is I've been an alcoholic. And these other things that have been a little dysfunctional in my life will probably now disappear. And it might take a year. a little optimistic there, Bob. And my wife thinks I'm still a little optimistic on that. At 30 years, it hasn't quite completed itself. And I had these other issues. They were horrible but ordinary, you know, just couldn't get up in the morning, set the alarm clock for 7, get up at 7:15, supposed to be at work at 8, you know, it's tough to be at work at 8 when you get up at 7:15. Alcoholics can do it, but it's hard on you. It's we're quick, and, you know, and I had financial difficulties. I spent about $300 more a month than I made, and if you do that over a long period of time, you end up in debt. Just want to report that to you in case you're running that one that you don't know where that goes. And I had work issues, you know. God, I did not know what to do at work. I just, even when I got there, you know, I just, you know, that was always a problem. Came late, left early. And I had a gambling problem, really more like a hobby. It was 3 or 4 hours a day, 4 or 5 days a week. But I was making $5,000 to $10,000 a year playing backgammon. So it was kind of a, you know, it was like a second job. I mean, I really viewed it as, and I had some marital issues, you know. We had Linda's father came home every night at 5:30. He was really, you know, straight arrow, set your watch by him. And I wasn't quite that regular. And, you know, I mean, you bring different views into marriage, you know. And she had this view, and I did not match the view, you know. And she was a nurse. She'd get up at 6, and I was sleeping. And then I'd come home maybe at 5:30 around that, and she'd broil something. Oh, she only knew how to broil, so we'd broil a lot of things. And then I'd go to the meeting, and I'd come back at, 11, 12, 1, you know, and she's in bed. And she was seeing less of me married than we were when we were going together. And she's starting to get irritated. She's starting to wonder if one of the places I'm supposed to practice the principles is in our home. I thought, God, that's none of your business. I mean, you got your program, I got my, I mean, you know, what the hell are we talking about this for? And then we started to have children, and I had great mom and dad, but even great parents make mistakes, and I wasn't going to make the mistakes my parents made, and I didn't. I made all the mistakes they made and a bunch they never thought of. And I was loud, impatient, angry, immature, and sometimes violent with my children. I'm not proud of that fact, but that's, I think, an accurate description of how I was. You know, and these were not annual problems or quarterly problems or monthly, these were daily problems. I had every one of these problems in my first year of sobriety and never noticed them. Didn't. I was so excited about being an Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, it was just, you know, that honeymoon period where you just come in and feel like this is your place. You found out what's wrong and you're learning about the steps and you're learning about the program. And I would just start raving sober for about 3 years. I was everywhere. It was just this, you know, it's the only place in my life that worked. AA. You know, I mean, for an hour a day, I had a reprieve for 2 hours. I could go and I could sit and I could listen to these guys and gals, and it was just wonderful. And then one by one, after about a year, during my second year, I started to get in touch with what my defects of character were. And even though I'd done a fifth step in my first year, my fifth step was mostly like taking care of the things that made me a moral leper. You know, just the big chunks of crap that were in, you know, just kind of, you know, slimy things. Just kind of get them out of the way and move them over and, you know, but not much insight, you know, just kind of, you know, getting the junk out of the way. And then I would, you know, one by one, these little shortcomings would show up, and I would grab them by the throat and try to deal with them, because I thought, you know, and it was miserable. God, I made almost no progress. And my second year, they identify them. My third and fourth year, they're bothering me. My fifth year, they're eating my lunch. And by my sixth and seventh year, I'm ready to go out the door of AA. And I'm wondering if I need other meetings, Gamblers Anonymous. You know, I mean, if I had to go to a meeting for every issue I had, I would have been a busy young guy. And, you know, but I'm a great starter, poor finisher. I mean, I'm thinking that, you know, I mean, the church didn't work as well for me as it did for other people in my family, and my family didn't work as well for me as, you know, I get to places that work for other people, and they often don't work for me, and I'm 7 years sober, and why am I having the troubles I'm having, and da 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 da. And, you know, the new guy comes in at night, and I'm, you know, 6 years sober, get him a cup of coffee, sit down, and say, hey. But he shares a bushel basket full of cancer that he's got, you know, shares what's going on with the spouse and jail and all that stuff. And I'm saying, hey, I know it's tough. I know it's bad. But, God, I'm glad you're here. You're really in the right spot. You know, and you will not understand what I'm going to tell you. But if you just stay, don't drink, get a sponsor, and try, Just try some of the stuff that's in these steps in the books. Your life's going to change. See that guy over there? God, his life was just a mess, and he's just knocking it out of the park, and he's only 2 years sober. I said, this is, you know, this is not just a partial answer. This is great, and welcome to AA. Then I get in the car, and I drive home, and I say, Bob, when's it going to work for you? You're 6 years sober. You just bought a $300 sport coat today at a store that you had a $400 bill at. When are you going to stop doing that? When are you going to learn how to work? You do not have a pass. I mean, you are not independently wealthy. Almost everybody works. You better learn how to work. I mean, this is not, when are you going to stop spending money you don't have on things you don't need to impress people you don't like? You know, I mean, that is, when are you... Cecil Corrigo, 1971. And when are you going to be a better parent? When are you going to be more loving and gentle to your wife and kids? And I didn't know. I was really trying, and I was not doing very well. I knew what the answer was. I mean, you know, the two things that have saved my backside in Alcoholics Anonymous is I've always loved the old-timer, and I've always had, sponsor and teachers. And the other thing was I can't keep my mouth shut, so I generally was sharing at some level. My sponsor knew what was going on, but I would say at about the 65% level. You really can't give them the whole thing. It's kind of not fair to them. They're busy. And I didn't want to burden Warren. And I, that's just the way it was. And I knew what the answer was to find... something deeper spiritually, and find out what God had to do with Wednesday. And my problem was, go knock on the door, and God said, who's there? He said, God is Bob. God says, what do you want? And I said, well, boy, I'm busting my britches in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm 7 years sober, and my backside's falling off. I mean, I need some help. This is not, I'm on the down escalator walking up. Every time I take a breath, take a little resty poo, I'm down, at the bottom. I do, this is not going well. And I'd like to sign up. It seems like the people who signed up have a better deal going than I got going. And God's going to say, okay. I'm going to say, God, what do I do? And God's going to say, well, get up in the morning. Go to work. Stay at work. Don't spend more money than you have. Be kind and loving to your wife and children and stop gambling. And I'm going to say, God, if I knew how to do all those things, I wouldn't need God. that's the problem. So what's the sense of going to God if you can't fulfill the conditions of the relationship? As soon as I clean my act up, I'm going to have a relationship with God. But, right now, we're having a conflict, and I can't resolve the conflict. And I was kind of stuck in that place for almost 2 years. And, you're at that point where you're either going to commit suicide or you're going to go talk to your sponsor. You're flipping a coin, you're right at the edge. And I went back to the steps with a ferocity that I had not been at them for a while. I took step one, 8 years sober, and I found out what powerlessness and unmanageability meant to me. It wasn't very difficult. Boy, I was powerless, and my life was unmanageable. The one that fooled me was step two. Step two for me was a throwaway step. I believed it. Put my hand on a lie detector test. Do you believe God's going to restore us to sanity? Answer, yes. Needle doesn't move. Different question if you say, do you believe God's going to restore Bob to sanity? At 8 years sober, the answer to the question was no. Because I'm going backwards. It is not, I feel like I'm failing. I feel like I am on my way out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going backwards, not forwards. And I had I think when you're in trouble, you either get more active or less active, and I got more active, and I was allowed to see the miracle again. I started to see people with smiles on their faces with larger problems than I had walking through those problems with a sense of, with dignity and grace. And I, again, sober 8 years, came to believe that God would restore Bob to sanity. That was a very specific thing that I had to reclaim for myself. Took my third step on my knees with my sponsor. Not done that before. It was awkward and embarrassing, but I just wanted, thought, what the hell? I'm going to, really try this thing. We didn't do that much, in our group. But I said, I want to really not miss anything. And I took a fourth step, and my previous two fifth steps had been with clergy, and I won my sponsor, and I said, I'm going to take a fifth step and be careful, because when you're done, I'm going to do whatever you recommend. I said, I feel like I'm lying next to a lake dying of thirst. I said, I know where the water is, I know what I'm supposed to do, and I can't do it. It is just, I am in as much pain as I have ever been in. I'm in as much pain at 8 years of sobriety as I was when I walked in the front door of Alcoholics Anonymous. You ruined it for me. I mean, it is now I'm honest enough that I no longer can deny most of the things that are going on in my life, and but I can't change the things that are going on in my life, and I'm just well enough to know I'm a horse's ass, and I'm not well enough to be able to stop being a horse's ass. And so I did my four step, took my fifth, we talked and cried and chatted a little bit. One of the things you want me to do is go to an industrial psychologist. Oh, God, I did not want to do that. I thought that was an admission of failure in my program. But I had a lot of issues around success and money, and my father was a real successful guy, kind of my hero, and I thought I'd never be as good as my own man, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I thought, well, I'll go. So I went to the psychologist, and he said, well, you get your parents involved. I said, no. I said, my parents have been dealing with me all their damn lives. And I said, if you can't help me, please get me someone, refer me to someone who can without getting my mom and dad involved. They're almost 70 years old. He said, well, will you get your wife involved? I thought, oh, crap. Well, they see things so differently. It's it's a different data pool. It's kind of confusing. And I thought, yeah, I'll get Linda involved. Well, you get the kids involved. I thought, well, they're pretty young, but yeah. So we get into this thing, and we got into this, you know, success and failure and all this stuff. And he said, you know, why are you so afraid of failure? And I just wanted to pull his nose off his face. I said, listen, jerk, you're a doctor. You know, you fail, you know, you just take your little sign, go walk down the hall, put it on another door, and you're making $100,000. And I said, I'm about to fail, and I'm going to lose, you know, I'm going to lose my business. I'm going to file bankruptcy. I'm going to lose everything I have. You know, it's going to be over. He looked over at my wife, and he said, Linda, if Bob lost everything he had, would he lose you? Linda said, no, wouldn't lose me. He looked over at Billy and Peter, and he said, if your dad lost everything he had, would he lose you? And the kid said, oh, hell no. You know, if you can't lose, you can't play. Okay. Now, I have been a guy who was always in a football team, had the uniform, did the calisthenics, did the locker room, but when they blocked and tackled and blew the whistle, I went up in the stands. I don't block and tackle. But in life, there's no stands. It's all playing field. I often wondered why I had these bruises on my body, you know. And, you know, I'm a great starter, but I'm a poor finisher. I don't finish anything. If we had a foot race and I, you know, I'd talk and sound like a great runner, you know, I'd have good shorts and a nice t-shirt, great pair of shoes. Tell you I won a race in Minnesota. And when we took off in the race, you know, I'd sound like, you know, you'd think I should be one of the top 10 guys in the race. And for the first maybe quarter of the race, I would be. But then somewhere between a quarter and halfway through the race, I'd fall down and hurt myself. When the race was over, they say, gee, what happened to that guy from Minnesota? And I say, I don't know. God, he was up front for a while. And won some race in Minnesota. I think he pulled a hamstring or something. Really too bad. But if you would have followed me around in a helicopter the previous 3 years of my life, you would have been able to guess within 25 feet of when I would have fallen down. Because I don't finish anything. And that gets old. You don't finish school, you don't finish work, you don't finish parenting, you don't finish marriage, you just don't finish anything. And I was a salesman who did not make sales calls. I mean, you couldn't even accidentally grab me by the throat and sign a sales order because I wasn't there. I just phonied up activity report. I only worked about an hour a day wondering why things were going bad. And, you know, I mean, it just, if you would have asked me what my biggest problem was, I would have said anger. What I found out working with that psychologist accidentally is that my biggest problem was fear. Anger was my reaction to fear. And I was so afraid that I could not do these things. And not too long after I took my fifth step, went to the psychologist, I was home one night, had one of the worst nights I ever had in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had gotten up late, went to work late, left early, got in a backgammon game, won $600, missed dinner, missed the AA meeting, got in a fight with my wife and slapped one of the kids. It was one of those days you would have liked to have had videotaped and sent to the General Service Office to show what 8 years of sobriety can do. And poster child for recovery. You know, afraid to death your sponsor might just pop in, you know, and see how it really is. And I said, gee, it happened again. And I said, what do you mean it happened again? Weren't you there? I think it's your life. And I said, yeah, I'm there, but it's almost like a blackout. I mean, it just kind of happens. It's so habitual. There's just no thinking that needed. It's just, before I know it, you're just kind of, and all of a sudden I realized that was a bunch of crap. That my life was the way it was because I designed it to be the way it was. I sounded like a guy who wanted to stop gambling. If you really wanted to know if I wanted to stop gambling, talk to my business partner and talk to my wife. I was a guy who wanted to gamble whenever the hell I wanted to gamble for as much money as I wanted to gamble and not have problems because of gambling. Sounded like I wanted to straighten up my finances. Hell, I wanted to spend money whenever the hell I wanted to spend and not have difficulty because of, you know. I wanted my wife and children's love and attention without spending time with them. I wanted money without work. Not the design of life. And all of a sudden I realized that, you know, that I built this monster. And I guess out of fear of getting drunk or out of fear of just continuing to be a sober ass, I got down on my knees and I realized that I had tried as hard as I knew how to try to clean my act up and I had failed and I realized that I was exactly where I was supposed to be. And I was given the grace to take the sixth and the seventh step of AA. The sixth step said that we're entirely ready to have God remove our defects of character. The seventh step said that we humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. I have spent 8 years trying to get rid of my defects of character. I do not have the muscle and power to get rid of my defects of character. I am the pipe, not the well. It happens through me, not by me. I have to cooperate. I have to get in the game. It can't happen without me. But I am not the source of power. I've been trying to grab my life. My idea was you get me sober and I'll take it from there. You get me sober, I'll be a good husband. You get me sober and I'll work. Everybody knows. Just, you know, you handle my alcoholism, I'll handle life. Not, you know. And I got down on my knees, took the six and a seven step, and five of the major problems of my life disappeared that night. Such, I believe, is the power of God and the six and the seven step of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Do you know how we change in Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, a doctor doesn't heal. He creates an aseptic environment, creates an atmosphere in which healing can take place, and God heals. A farmer doesn't grow. He plants a seed in a fertile environment, and God grows. And we don't change. We create an atmosphere in which change can take place. And that atmosphere, I believe, is the attitude involved in the sixth and the seventh step. I believe they are profound. I believe they are critical in the program. I think that if I asked all of us in the audience to raise our hands and say, how many of us want to change? How many of us want to get rid of the things that don't work in our lives? How many of us want to get rid of the things that hurt the people we care about in our lives? That almost all of us would raise our hands. I want to give you a little secret. We don't want to change. Don't want to change. I got a deal that I do with some of the guys I sponsor. You know how it's kind of complicated, you know, the fourth step, the way it is in the book, all that kind of stuff. You know, it's got columns and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And I don't know whether we're a little slow in Minnesota, but it's difficult. It's kind of awkward and, you know. I got a new deal I do. Pretend I got a 35-year-old guy that's married that I'm sponsoring. And I say, okay, I know you're having a little trouble, Joe. I say, okay, just get your wife and your kids and bring them over to the house and your mom and dad and brother and sister maybe and your boss and a couple of neighbors, a couple of people you work with. And two people from your group. And bring them over and just say, we have this step in Alcoholics Anonymous where we try to get in touch with our defects of character, and I am having difficulty identifying them. And I was wondering if you'd help. And and then just hand out the tablets and leave. And now, do you know why we laugh at that? Because we wouldn't call the meeting. Do you know why? We don't want to change. We really don't want to change. And it's even worse than that, kids. We don't want to know. We don't even want to know. So you get to a certain spot in the program, and you make deals. You look at your wife and you say, we're not talking about that. Nod your head up and down if you understand that. We're not talking about it. You want to talk about that? It's going to be expensive. I mean, it's not going to be for free. We are not talking, you train your kids as to what they can talk about. We're not talking about that. You train your sponsees. The ideal is that we can talk about the steps, traditions, great traditions are great. You just don't call me on my crap. I won't call you on yours. You got that? Well, you got it. You got to set, otherwise it's uncomfortable. I mean, the gamblers hang out with the gamblers and the chasers hang out with the chasers and the money spenders. I mean, you got to set this thing up. Otherwise, it's real uncomfortable. I mean, No, it's supposed to be a supportive environment. It is. So, I mean, these people who just want to change all the time, I mean, they're not supportive. And so you really, I mean, they aren't. It is, Scott Peck is the guy who wrote a book called A Road Less Traveled, and later on wrote another book called Further Along A Road Less Traveled. In that book, he has a book about death and a chapter about death and dying, called A Road to Omaha, and he talks about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's stages of death and dying, you know, the anger, denial, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And, you know, that you get cancer, and, you know, the first thing is denial, maybe I don't have it, you know, and you get a second opinion, that sort of thing. And then anger, why is this happening to me? You know, I've lived a good life. Look at Harry, he's, you know, 80 years old and the horse's ass, and I, you know, you get the anger sort of thing. And then bargaining, you know, God, please remove this, and I will, you know, go to China, devote my life to you, do whatever I have to do. And then when all those fail and your little nose is pushed in the cow pie and you can't ignore it and you are in front of, you know, it, you go into a depression. And I'm now not talking about a clinical depression. I'm talking about a depression due to the circumstances, not trying to play doctor. And then he uses a phrase that I never used, heard someone else say. He said, but if you allow depression to do its work, okay, which I have taken from my own personal experience to mean grind the ego to dust. You go through the depression into acceptance. Now, he said most people, when they hear the stages of death and dying, they think that everybody goes through those stages, but they don't. They go through the denial, anger, and bargaining, but the depression is too painful, and they back off. And they go back and recycle through the denial, anger, and bargaining. And he said something fascinating. He said, and interestingly enough, this is a process we go through with major changes in our lives. We do not view change as change. We view it as death. We built, you know, we have the problems that we have. The problems we have are not new. I mean, if we were listing our problems, kids, they would not be new. Not in the last week, not in the last month. I mean, some of them are really old. But we have them filed under answer, solution, not problem. Haven't worked in 15 goddamn years, and we have them filed in the computer under answer. We do. Call them up, and that's what, I mean, that is why we are afraid to give them up. At some, I'm dead serious about this. Anger being one. A lot of guys, and I know none of the guys in the room that are 40 or 50 years old have any issue with anger. But in Minnesota, we got, I mean, I'm telling you, I don't know what the, I think it's the water. I really do. Because there's a lot of angry guys that are in their 50s and 60s. I don't know what the hell it is, but we're working on it. We got new study committee and stuff like that. And, but a lot of guys think it's a tool. You know, when your wife brings up something you don't want to talk about, if you just kind of elevate your voice a little bit, she stops. I mean, that's workable, isn't it? Your children bug you a little bit. Just kind of raise your voice and get a little stern, and they back off. Now, they get this kind of sad, crappy look in their eyes, and it's, you know. But if you don't look at it, it's very effective. It works. And coworkers stay away from you. They don't bother you because they know you're a little testy and you know how it is. And I mean, it's a tool. I don't know why anybody would want to get rid of something that works so well. I don't, we got them filed under answer. We do not want to change. We do not want to know. It is not, and I'll tell you, you know, when I went through that second surrender at 8 years of sobriety, I mean, I used to think that what recovery was the absence of problem. I don't know who told me that. I mean, if I would have asked me to define recovery, what is it? It's the absence of problem. And so when I had problems, I felt dirty about them. I hid them. I built the wall back up. You know, the wall that we have built up so people can't see what's going on behind you? You know, Thank you very much for helping my drinking problem to stay out of my marriage. Thank you very much for helping my drinking problem to stay out of my sex life, stay out of my business, stay out of my parenting, stay out of my finances, you know. Brick by brick, sober and Alcoholics Anonymous, I built the wall back up. Everybody's telling me what a good job I'm doing. I'm active in service and doing all the... And I'm saying, can't you see this? I'm in meetings with you 4 days a week. My life is a mess. And can't you see? And I wouldn't tell. I didn't want to disappoint anybody. And I felt as isolated in my sobriety to some extent as I did. I could sound like I was really plugged in, but I wasn't plugged in. And I had to, at 8 years of sobriety, tear that wall down and make the discovery. Clancy talks about if there ever was a flag we could all pledge our allegiance to, the flag would say, but I'm different, you know. And if you really feel unique, you're going to die in Alcoholics Anonymous, because you're not going to feel that what worked for me would work for you. And you have to tear that wall down and make the discoveries that you're not unique. Your personality may be unique, but not your illness, not your behavior, not your feelings, not your experience. And when you have that experience, when you find out you're not unique, you start to have a sense of hope that maybe what worked in your life would work in mine. Because when you're unique, you're looking for the differences. You're separate. And it's very hard in Alcoholics Anonymous. The grace doesn't come through when you're separated. When I made those changes at 8 years of sobriety, when you're really serious about a change, I'm a guy who, when I go on a diet, the first thing I do is I buy a bag of cookies and a quart of ice cream. It's the last day I'm going to eat. I mean, it's already been a bad day. I'm just going to finish it off. I probably will never have ice cream again. I won't. So I'm just going to have a little bit. Well, if you've been there and done that and have the T-shirt, you understand. When I made those changes, when you're serious about it, I think you put a structure of support in. And I made a deal with my psychologist and my sponsor. I made appointments about when I'd go to work, how long I would stay at work, and when I would leave. I turned the finances over to my wife. My wife did not have the ego issues with money that I had. She had this new scientific, she could pay a third of a bill. Damnedest thing I have ever seen. I always thought if you paid a third, they'd think you didn't have the money. And, but she could do that. And she had our finances straightened out in about 6 months. And I went on an allowance. And I started dating my wife. I dated my wife every Friday night for the last 22 years. And, you know, I was so busy and I had her love and affection. It was everybody else's love and affection I was trying to get. I had to learn how to go back and be romantic with my wife. I had to go back and kind of treat my wife like I would have if I would have gotten a new mistress or something. You know, like I would have, you know, put the excitement back. We were just talking business. We were always talking kids and house and money and stuff and, you know, missing each other. We were just, you know, I'm busy with the meetings and she's busy, you know, and we were just missing each other. And so now we know, and when I, you know, tonight I'll probably take her out tomorrow, Sunday night when I go home. I just change nights. That's been one of the most important things that has happened. And remember, we know that one night a week we have each other's undivided attention. And I had to learn how to be, we learned again how to be with each other and enjoy each other. I have spent thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours learning how to be a better parent. I think being a parent takes 125% of whatever you got. I mean, it's a big job. I mean, it is, you know, I kind of glibly said in the beginning about our kids being in treatment. You don't feel like a win, you know, everybody said, oh, great. It isn't great. I mean, it doesn't feel great when your kids, you know, got alcoholism. You don't feel like you parented very well when your 17-year-old is out riding his little bicycle on cocaine. It is not, you know, they're not going to put your name in for Parent of the Year. And, you aren't supposed to judge yourself about how your kids are doing as, you know, how you're, you know, but it just isn't that simple. It is, you know, not everybody who gets the disease gets well, you know, and you're tired of being a recessive gene pool. You know, it is just, and I turned my wife in as a carrier. I think there's a lot of evidence now. Most people think it's me, but truth is it's neither of us, but it feels like it's us. And you feel responsible. These are, you know, when children have adult problems, you feel responsible. And you are responsible. You know, but I think parenting, you know, it's just an enormous job. And Chuck, I think, came as close to it as anybody when he said, treat them like drunks. And what he meant more than anything else is that we seem to have the capacity to give love to people we sponsor without taking on the full burden of their problems. And I, you know, I, to the best of my ability, I do that. I have a pretty good relationship with my kids today. It's better than it's ever been. And that's due to you. And it is, you know, it's different today. When I made those changes, my life took off like a rocket ship. But for about 8 or 9 years, everything I touched turned to gold. I made enough money to burn a wet elephant, and I learned how to work. And, you know, I was kind of in the right place at the right time. I was in the real estate investment business. And then, you know, bought the big house, Mercedes, all this stuff. But, you know, it was an interesting time. You know, there's issues with failure, but there's also issues with success. I was a guy who, you know, I mean, I bought this big old place, and, you know, I had the big Mercedes, the little one, you know, for different seasons, and, you know, and I paid for them. I mean, it didn't feel like, you know, didn't feel like I was doing anything, but my life became about me. I got deeply shallow during that, and I found out I had a gift for it. A lot of people don't do shallow well. I think I do shallow really great, and, you know, but if you really want to have a kind of a crappy time in your life, give yourself your own undivided attention. Make your life about what you want it to be. You know, kind of center it. You want this, you go get this. I mean, just, it is, and that's how it was. And it was, you know, you don't, during the best of times, you don't learn much. You know, we talk about problems or opportunities, they are. The problems that I had before was the universe saying to me, change. Was the universe saying to me, it is not working. I wanted a different message. But where, if God wanted to say something to you, how would he say it? I mean, if the intention is to look for God's will for us, how would he get the message to us? How would she get the message to us? You know, the main way that he gets the messages to me, one of the main ways is through my wife, through my partner. Don't like that answer. That's a bad answer, isn't it? I mean, just everybody raise their hands if they don't like that one. I mean, that is, you know, your children, your boss, your parents. Now, it's often an imperfect message. It often has a little heat on it. Sometimes it's a little bit of a slider, you know, a little. But that's how we get the message, through your group, through your sponsor. There's avenues. We don't have as many direct conferences as we, you know, would like to think. You know, it's almost always through someplace else. And mostly we don't want the message. It is, and I don't know what that is, why our egos are so protective. They're just afraid that they're going to die. And so my life took off, and I was making all this money in the 1986 they passed the Tax Act, and my success came to a screeching halt. And by 1989, I am 22 years sober, and I am going broke. I went to my spiritual advisor in 1989, and I asked this man to be my spiritual, and he said, what do you want? I said, I want two things. I said, I want to be more loving. I talked to him about Bob White. I said, Bob White is my hero. He said, everybody likes to be around Bob. They like who they are when they're around Bob White. I want people, I'm real competitive. I want to be a little better than you, a little fast, have a little bit more, and I'd like you to know it. And, and I said, I would like to stop that game. And I would like to be a guy who people like themselves when they're around me. And I said, the other thing, I'd like to be less materialistic. And within about 3 weeks, I started to lose everything I had. True story. And I called George up. I said, George, we've got to talk. And I said, what I meant to say, I wasn't very careful when we had the conversation. And what I meant to say is that I wanted to keep the stuff and be less materialistic. And in a period of about 3 years, I lost everything. I lost about $8 million, big house. I lost everything. I was in the hole. And it was not like changing clothes. It was like tearing skin off my body. And Peter was in treatment. Peter had gone away to college in his freshman year, and he came back, and he got arrested for drunken driving, ended up in detox, and totaled the car. It was a Christmas present to his mother and I. And and I'm now I'm at the halfway house where he's in, you know, in extended care, and I go to the meeting. I start crying when the meeting starts. I can't stop. I mean, I just cry through the, you know, and the, you know, I'm sure everybody's looking over there saying, "Isn't that Bob Bazance? I think he's got about 23 years. I'd like to have what he has." I think he has a clap. I'm not sure. It doesn't look, you know. God. And when you get in more trouble, you know, I think you either get more active or less active, but I got more active than I started to go to more meetings. And I found out, you know, when you have a problem and you don't want to change it, when you're so deeply immersed in it, I think God has to ratchet, the universe has to make the noise louder. And that's how loud the noise had to get to find out who I was without money. I had to learn that lesson. Today, I would not trade the money for the lesson. I think it was one of the most important lessons of my life. I would take the money and the lesson. Just wanted to throw that in, you know, just as a little IQ test. I had to find out who I was without the money. And today, you know, it's okay. I'm in love with my wife. I am self-supporting through my own contributions. You know, I'm an imperfect but active parent. And it's okay. It's even better than okay. It's just fine. And there's a peace today. I think throughout the early part of my life, I wanted thrills. I thought that was happiness. And today I have a peace. And today I have a joy that is more sustaining. It is different. I have the ability. I spent most of the early part of my life like a monkey on a string. I was like a jukebox. You put a quarter in the jukebox and you push B5 and I played B5. I got an impulse response, impulse response, impulse response, impulse response. No space. No opportunity to change that. Now, I get an impulse, and I have just a space in which to make a choice. It has taken me a disgustingly long period of time to have that space. And inside that space, I am a human being. I am not a monkey on a string. I still am impatient and sometimes angry with my children. But what has happened is you have awakened me. I am no longer asleep. I used to do a lot of things asleep. And at least I am awake that most of the time today, I don't react. I have a choice to respond. And it's really different. It is, you know, it is really different. And I treasure the ability to choose. I treasure the peace that comes with that process of not having to hurt people, you know. God, if there's one thing, you know, that I'd like to remove from my life is hurting people. Just stop doing that. Just get even, you know. Now, I mean, you know, get back to even, you know, stop digging the hole. And I think when it's all said and done, I think our program is about love. If you want to take a look at the direction, it is not about how many merit badges you get. You know, a lot of people talk about being a great AA is what you do in AA. How many people you sponsor, how many meetings you go to, what you do, and that's part of it. But boy, I tell you, it's much more about asking your family, or your neighbors, or your boss, or your friends. Has Mary been, you know, a better person today than she was 3 years ago? It's much more, the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is return us to life. It is not meant just to be a place to hide, to have life within. And I'm not, you know, and it's a great place to hide. I hid in Alcoholics Anonymous for a period of years, and I'm pleased that I had a place to hide. I also report that. You got to do the best you can do. And over a period of time, it's changed. What I can do at 30 years of sobriety is different than what I could do when I was 10 years sober. I have learned how to be everything. You know, I came in when I was 23 years old, and now I'm, you know, 54 years old. And it is, you know, I've had to learn how to be a man, a husband, a parent, a worker. I've learned almost everything I have, and I've made my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. It is so different. I never expected, had I written down what I wanted when I walked in the front door of Alcoholics Anonymous, it wouldn't have been anything like it. You know, I wouldn't have known what to put down. You could have told me the things to put down, and I wouldn't have wanted. I just wanted
a little bit of money in to get the heat off and get rid of a couple. I would have just settled for little trinkets when I came in. You know, so many of us, you know, this is the service conference and the state conference, and there's an awful lot of people here. And I know one of the things we would all like to do is to help ensure the future of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to tell a little story about ensuring the future of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if we were all, everybody in this room, going to take a spaceship ride to the nearest star. The nearest star is a star called Alpha Centauri, approximately, and it's 4 light years away. And if we got in a spaceship and we went 100,000 miles an hour, it would take us 300 years to get there and 300 years to get back. And when we started out on that trip, everybody would know who we were and where we had come from and where we were going and why we were going there. We'd all be together. But it isn't very hard to imagine that if we weren't very careful in passing that message down, unchanged and intact to each other, that 200 years from now, we could literally be a spaceship just chock full of people who were lost in space. The message of who we are, where we have come from, and where we are going and why we are going there is contained in this book. A lot of people think it's just contained in the black part. And I think it's in the white part too. I believe that it's in the spirit of this book. I believe that it's this book put into action in our lives and lived in our lives that is the message of this book, not just this book. And that's why I'm grateful that my children found other people, you know, that could give them this message intact and unchanged. And I hope that we continue to do that. We will not save Alcoholics Anonymous by giving urine tests at the door. We will not save Alcoholics Anonymous with rules. If you want to save Alcoholics Anonymous, practice the principles in all your affairs. You will be so damn attractive, we will have to beat people away with sticks.